Maddie is brought to you by 9.com.au. To enjoy some of our other great shows, such as NRL podcast Six Tackles with Gus, or our deep dive into the royal family, the Windsors, head to 9.com.au/podcasts or search for us wherever you listen.
In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
A few days before the first episode of Maddie got released, I had a phone conversation with an interesting figure from Boston. I'd come across this man's work while researching the case, and I was pleased when I saw he responded to an email that I'd sent. In his email, which was brief, he told me to give him a call, which I did.
Well, my name is Joseph Mora. I was a investigative consultant with the CBS News, the show 48 Hours, and I got assigned the case to go to Algarve in Portugal to look into the Maddie McCann matter in reference to who was responsible in reference to her disappearance.
Joseph Mora has been a private detective for almost 40 years. The US broadcaster CBS News occasionally hires Joseph to investigate stories that their journalists are working on, particularly for their flagship show 48 Hours. Joseph speaks Portuguese, so he was a great asset for CBS to send to Praia da Luz in the months after Maddie vanished.
It's a mystery that has captured the attention of the world. Tonight, with the help of one of America's top investigators,
everything you read in the press is nonsense, it's trash.
We separate fact from fiction.
Was this an accidental death that was covered up? Was this a murder that was covered up? Or was this an abduction?
48 Hours hired Mora to go undercover at the Ocean Club.
Hello, I didn't fire your phone during the massage, okay? Please.
His assignment, determine if Maddie was abducted or if her parents were involved. He familiarized himself with the layout of the resort, the McCann's apartment, and its proximity to the tapas bar, where the McCann's ate that night.
Joseph told me he'd been deployed to Portugal for a couple of weeks and had worked on the case for CBS for several months. During our conversation, he hit me between the eyes with a couple of big statements. One was about Jane Tanner, who you'll remember told police she saw a man carrying a child on the night that Madeline vanished. Jane's statement had also placed Jerry on the street with a friend at a time when an abduction was taking place, and it set the early direction of the police investigation.
I disregarded her statement as being erroneous.
The other was about the checking system the McCanns and their friends said they had conducted on the night Madeline disappeared.
They clearly told me that particular night nobody left the table. And that was goes by the bartender and that goes by the waitresses. And they didn't go and check on the children periodically because they said they did.
It's a pretty big allegation from Joseph Mora that there was no checking system on the night of May 3. So let's take a closer look at that. Here's Joseph on his arrival and mission in Praia da Luz.
I registered as a guest in the compound where the family had been staying. So for the first week, I basically took a very neutral role in pretty much like undercover as just a guest of the compound by, you know, having my meals at the same restaurant, the tapas restaurant, by sitting at the bar, getting to know the the individuals here, the employees. I focused very strongly on that for the first week, just to get a feel what the locals were saying, and especially the employees.
Here's a little more audio from the CBS investigation, Where's Maddie, which aired in November 2007.
Throughout his time of working undercover for 48 hours, no one at the Ocean Club ever discovered who Joe Mora really was. Mora focused on what happened at this dinner table on May the 3rd, where the McCanns and their friends would meet.
Joseph Mora told me he had unearthed eyewitness accounts from employees who were working in the restaurant that night, which contradicted the claims of the McCanns and the Tapas 7.
They didn't realize I was an investigator. They had no idea that I was working with 48 hours in CBS. I was just a tourist who happened to speak their language. And so I got to know them pretty well in that week's period of time. And you're spending a lot of time by the pool, and you're spending time at the bar and the restaurant.
He claimed the bartender and waitress who served the group that night told him no one left the table on May 3. But is it possible those employees just never noticed people getting up and down to go and check on the kids? Well, according to the official police records, there were 6 Tapas restaurant workers rostered on that night. All of them were interviewed by police on May 4. 2 of the 6 workers were chefs or backroom staff, so they had no views of the restaurant. The other 4 observed some movement. You'll remember the barman said one person from the group left the table during dinner, and a waitress said she thought Jerry McCann left the table for 30 minutes. Another waiter told police a tall man left the group's table for 15 minutes. Then that same waiter said a second man left for about 30 minutes. The waiter said when that man returned, everyone left the table, as a small girl had gone missing. According to the accounts of the McCanns and the Tapas 7, there were many absences from the table. Matthew Oldfield leaves at 8:55 p.m. Jerry McCann leaves at 9:05 p.m. Jane Tanner leaves at 9:10 p.m. Matt Oldfield and Russell O'Brien both leave at 9:30 p.m. And finally, Kate McCann leaves at 10 p.m. To give you a sense of the size of the restaurant, Kate McCann's book states there was only room for 15 dinner guests, so the Tapas 7 and the McCanns occupied most of the total dining allocation. I asked Joseph about his claim that there appeared to be no checking schedule on the night of May 3. I asked him, why would that be?
The family and the friends were extremely embarrassed because the general public came really strong. How could parents leave their children alone and go out and party all night long? Now, let's not get carried away. They weren't out partying all night long. They were very close to where the children were, but unfortunately, they didn't have a view of the doorway. The way that was laid out there, and this is another thing they just kept saying, well, we could see. No, you couldn't see. There was a wall, and there's bushes on top of the wall. The only thing they could see of that apartment was the roof. You could not see the entryways. You could not see the doors from where they were sitting at the table. I sat at that table. I had dinner at that table. You had absolutely no view. The only view you had was of a swimming pool right next to you, and on the other side is the wall. The swimming pool is the wall with the bushes on top, and they didn't go and check on the children periodically because they said they did.
Whatever you might make of the group's checking schedule and routine, Joseph Mora expresses a high level of confidence about a couple of things.
I think Maddie's dead. I thought so back then. I think so today. There's no question in my mind that child was abducted. You know, let's say hypothetically that somehow the child died in the apartment and they got nervous and they had to dispose of the body and this and that. All these things take time. And we know when the parents were last seen. We know when the mother was last seen. We know when the father went into that apartment and then came out. There's just no time. There's not enough time to go bury the child at the, if you remember, there was someone was buried in the church or was thrown out to sea. There was all kinds of theories. But in my professional opinion, I think it's a closed case and there'll never be a solution to it.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeleine McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case.
Now, London police are refusing to take up an offer from a DNA expert to help solve the disappearance of Madeleine McCann. The disappearance of three-year-old Madeleine has plagued investigators for more than a decade. 11 years and $20 million later, the investigation into her disappearance has not solved the mystery. But there is a renewed focus on this case, thanks to a riveting podcast called Maddie, which has been done by 9.com.au. Now, the latest twist is that Scotland Yard is refusing to accept an offer which could shine light on this case. American DNA expert Dr. Mark Perlin is offering to work for free to analyse important DNA samples linked to Maddie McCann's disappearance.
Ben Fordham is the host of Sydney's most popular drive time show on radio station 2GB. He's a big advocate of highlighting cold cases or miscarriages of justice. Ben aired his thoughts about Dr. Perlin, the DNA, and Operation Grange. He was asking the same questions that a lot of people have been asking me.
Recently, with the podcast attracting a lot of attention, London police were reminded that a top DNA expert wants to help. So, finally this week, the creator of the Maddie podcast received a note from Scotland Yard saying, "Police won't provide a running commentary." So, does that mean that they don't want the help of one of the world's most respected DNA experts? Mark Perlin's lab, Cybergenetics, was used to identify victims of the September 11 terror attacks. He's got a track record of success in this field. No offence to the detectives in the UK, but they have struggled to find answers despite spending $21 million on their investigation. They say their investigation is ongoing, but by the sounds of things, they're treating it like case closed. So where's the next move on this one? Well, that's up to Scotland Yard.
In this episode of Maddie, we're going to look at claims from Gonzalo Amaral that call logs on Kate and Jerry's mobile phones could have been manipulated the day after Maddie vanished. We'll also review a strange incident during quiz night at the tapas bar and a couple of other odd parts of this case which could leave you scratching your head. But before we kick on with episode 7, I just want to bring everyone up to speed on the latest DNA developments. There's been a lot of discussion and interest in the DNA and Dr. Perlin's offer to Scotland Yard. So I wanted to talk to him about that, what DNA transference means, and precisely how his work could help detectives. Last week I spent some time reviewing the DNA reports the Forensic Science Service, the FSS, had produced on the case in 2007. Dr. Perlin had told me he needed to go to Operation Grange detectives requesting access to specific DNA samples. That approach, he said, would be much better than a generic offer to simply help Scotland Yard. In total, I narrowed it down to 18 samples that the FSS had struggled with and could not analyse. 2 were from the rental car, and 16 were from the living room of the holiday apartment, specifically around the blue two-seat sofa where the cadaver and blood dog had alerted. Those 16 DNA samples were from tiles lifted up from the floor, curtains that reached that floor area, and skirting boards against the wall behind the couch. I sent summaries of those 18 samples to Dr. Perlin, detailing where they were taken from and the reasons why the FSS could not analyse them. After he'd had some time to look over them, I asked him what he thought.
We often get reports like this when groups send us data, whether they're prosecutors, defenders, investigators. We have these summaries, and when we look at it, we see language like the language we see here. We see descriptions that will say maybe there's 3 or more people and that there was a small amount of DNA. And therefore, because there's too many contributors and there's not enough DNA, it's too complex for interpretation. That phrase appeared 6 times on the holiday apartment sample, and another phrase, too meager, meaning the signal was too low for their interpretation, appeared another half dozen times. So my impression was that there's potentially a lot of information here. This is the type of DNA sample where the human analyst is seeing signals. They're seeing that there's some information there. They can't interpret it, but it's totally amenable to computer interpretation. So that was my impression, looking over these descriptions, is that the data looked like it could be very, very informative.
Armed with that information, Dr. Perlin wrote to Detective Chief Inspector Nicola Wall, the head of Operation Grange.
I described, you know, what the problem was and how we can solve it in basic layman's terms. And then I described the work that we had done for the UK police, and throughout the Commonwealth, just briefly for the last 20 years in major crime. I'd hoped that she'd be interested in our helping them unravel the inconclusive Madeleine McCann DNA evidence, and stressed that we're happy to help.
As I reviewed those FSS reports for Dr. Perlin, one thing had caught my attention. The FSS kept referring to DNA in the car and apartment 5A, coming from cellular material. It was repeated over and over, cellular material. Curious, I asked Dr. Perlin about that. He told me in a forensics lab, a serology unit conducts tests to establish what the cellular material is, before those findings are passed on to a team of DNA scientists. I asked Dr. Perlin what kind of biological material the term cellular material could include.
This material, it could be blood, semen, touch DNA, saliva.
Dr. Perlin said that a serology report would exist which would explicitly state what kind of cellular material is being referred to. Another thing worth discussing is transference of DNA. Some people have asked, if Madeleine's DNA is found to be present in the car, couldn't it just be transference? It's a good question, and one I put to Dr. Perlin. What is transference, and is transference possible?
That is possible, but it's sort of putting the cart before the horse. Usually, one would determine that there is DNA present and analyze it and make comparisons to determine who had left their DNA and an evidence item and who hadn't. Then questions of a possible transfer of DNA would come up afterwards. So secondary DNA transfer could occur, for example, imagine there was a suitcase in someone's apartment and DNA was left in some reasonably large quantity on that suitcase. And then that suitcase was moved into the luggage compartment of a car. Then the DNA from the person who left it at another location could have it be deposited at a new location. And that would mean that the person was never present, but that their DNA had been transferred from another location to where the DNA was found. That's DNA transfer. There's a whole science of DNA transfer. It's not that common. It can happen.
There was another thing Dr. Perlin had noted about the 18 samples I'd flagged up to him. He wasn't aware there had been so many inconclusive samples from apartment 5A. He believed if they could be resolved, they could be of real value for detectives. I asked Dr. Perlin what he might find if he gets the FSS data from DNA samples which were taken from around skirting boards and raised floor tiles in apartment 5A.
Essentially, what you end up with is a biological mapping of a crime scene. So there's this spatial mapping of who touched what or left their material at different locations that can aid investigators in understanding or reconstructing the events that happened. Right now, there's about 18 items of evidence at different locations, and we don't know who in the family has left their DNA on an item, who hasn't left their DNA. If two family members have touched the same item or left their DNA on it, we don't know that. If there's an unknown person, if there's an intruder who came in, whose DNA is on many items, that doesn't come back to any of the family members. We don't know that. Investigators need to reconstruct what happened and what the events that happened over a night or a week or 2 weeks. It can help an investigator understand who was where and what they may have done.
With that in mind, who better to ask than former top homicide detective Colin Sutton, who solved more than 30 murders for London Metropolitan Police. I asked Colin if Madeline's DNA was found to be present in the boot compartment of the rental car. How might investigators view that?
So on the basis that that car was only hired by the McCanns some sort of 3 weeks after Madeline disappeared, then it's a real game changer, isn't it? Because there is no way, according to the information that we have, that she could have been in that car, because when she disappeared, it was in the possession of the hire company or in the possession of another hirer, somebody else. So the big question then is, well, how can her DNA get into that car 3 weeks after she's disappeared?
I put the idea of DNA transference to Colin and asked if he'd ever encountered it in one of the murder investigations he had ran.
I've never come across it myself. I think it's theoretically it could happen with a substantial source of DNA. So if you had something that like a blood-soaked rag or something like that, and you wiped it somewhere else, then it would come off. But I mean, it would depend very much on the amount of source material that there is that it came from, I would think.
And finally, I asked Colin about DNA samples from apartment 5A. I wanted to know if Dr. Perlin resolved those 16 inconclusive samples from 5A, would that information be useful for detectives? Because, of course, Madeline and all her family had been in the apartment for 6 days. You'd expect to find DNA there, wouldn't you?
Where it would become interesting, and as I understand this, is the sort of situation that we have in 5A, is where the material bearing the DNA is found in locations which would not, in the ordinary course of events, be subject to regular touching and so forth. So if you've got a situation where there's material found in cracks and crevices between tiles and skirting boards and that sort of thing, what that would probably indicate a possibility of at least is that there's some kind of DNA bearing material has been there, and then some attempt has been made to clean the material off, but the cleaning process isn't good enough or thorough enough to get into each cracks and crevices where access was difficult. And that's the sort of thing that's much more kind of interesting from an investigative point of view, because you then can sort of start to ask the question, how did that material get into that inaccessible location, and what might it mean for what happened before and after?
May 3, 2007 is the date forever seared into the Madeline McCann case. But 2 days earlier, on May 1, something else occurred. Was it a random event, or was something more going on? If we go back to the night of May 1, 2007, it was a Tuesday evening, and there was a quiz night at the Tapas Bar. Maddie would be reported missing almost exactly 48 hours later. The quiz master, or in this case, the quiz mistress, was a 21-year-old British woman. Her name was Najoya Chakaya. She was an aerobics instructor at the Ocean Club Resort, but she also ran a quiz night at the Tapas Bar twice a week. In the aftermath of Maddie's disappearance, Najoya Chakaya was interviewed twice by police, once on May 9 and again a month later on June 20. This is what happened on the night of May 1, according to her police statement. She began the quiz night at 9 p.m. At about 9:30 p.m., Jerry McCann approached her and invited her to his table of friends. She agreed and stayed at the table for about 20 minutes. She made small talk with Jerry and the group. She noted there was one empty place at the table. In her interview, police pushed her to try and recall who of the McCanns in the Tapas 7 was not there. She said the empty table place setting looked like someone had eaten their dinner and then left. Police showed her photos of Kate and Jerry McCann and the Tapas 7. She said she couldn't remember seeing Kate McCann. She also wasn't sure if she had seen David Payne at the table. She said it was likely he was there, but she couldn't be certain. Later that Tuesday night, a couple of other things happened. Between 10:16 p.m. and 10:27 p.m., Kate McCann's phone was used 6 times inside a brief 11-minute period. We know of the activity on her phone because of records in the police files. Frustratingly, the police files do not show us who Kate was texting or calling, or who was calling and texting Kate. We just know Kate was using her phone. So where was Kate between 10:16 p.m. and 10:27 p.m. when she was using her phone? Clarence Mitchell, the McCann spokesperson, gave an interview to British Sunday paper The Observer in April 2008. In it, he suggested the McCanns and the Tapas 7 did not take their mobile phones or watches out to dinner at the Tapas bar. Here's what he said. You had 9 people in a bar without watches on, without mobile phones, and absolute panic set in when they realised what had happened. So 2 thoughts on this. If Clarence Mitchell is right, it does beg the question. If no one had watches or phones, how were the group so certain of the timeline on May 3 when Maddie vanished? And if Clarence is right because no one took phones to dinner, does his comment suggest Kate was somewhere other than dinner with Jerry and the Tapas 7 during that burst of phone activity in the 11-minute window? We can't be certain, but it is certainly possible. At about 10:30 p.m. that night, just minutes after the burst of activity on Kate's phone, something else happened. Directly above the McCann's apartment lived a retired British woman, a woman named Pamela Fenn. On the night of May 1, at about 10:30 p.m., 3 minutes after Kate's phone was last used, Pamela Fenn told police she heard a young child crying. Mrs. Fenn made a police statement on August 20, 2007, 3 months after Maddie vanished. She told police the crying she had heard sounded like it was coming from a young child, not a baby under the age of 2, such as Sean or Emily. Mrs. Fenn said the crying lasted for 1 hour and 15 minutes, from 10:30 p.m. to 11:45 p.m. She said the crying was continuous. She said the crying grew increasingly louder and more expressive. She told police the child loudly cried out, "Daddy, Daddy." At about 11:45 p.m., just before midnight, Mrs. Fenn told police she heard the parents arrive back home. She didn't see anyone return, but she heard the patio door slide open and the crying stopped. A couple of questions worth thinking about here. Was it Kate and Jerry coming home together after quiz night, or was it Jerry coming home alone? Kate and Jerry both denied and rejected Pamela Fenn's account of the crying on May 1. One day before police made Kate an arguido, which was 4 months after Maddie vanished, Portuguese police called her in for questioning and put Mrs. Fenn's version of events to her. Kate said Mrs. Fenn's statement about the crying was not true. Kate told police she and Jerry got home together at 11 p.m. She told police she and Jerry had left the Tapas bar to check the children 4 times that night. Kate said Jerry went twice and she went twice. She said those checks happened around 9 p.m., 9:30 p.m., 10 p.m., and 10:30 p.m. The day after police had grilled Kate, they brought in Jerry for questioning. Before his interview started, they made him an arguido. Jerry had the right to silence, but he answered questions anyway. The police again appeared interested in Mrs. Fenn's account. They asked Jerry about the crying incident. Jerry said it was not true Maddie was crying for an hour and 15 minutes. In her tell-all 2011 book, Kate makes no mention of the quiz night. She makes no mention of whether she was or wasn't there. She doesn't mention if she left the table early. Kate, however, does state that on May 1, Maddie had wandered into their bedroom after midnight, sometime in the early hours. According to Kate's book, Madeline came in and said Emily had been crying and it had woken her up. Here on BBC Breakfast on May 1 in 2008, Kate and Jerry talk about that crying incident. There is contention over who was crying and when.
You said that the night before, Madeline and Sean had been very upset. I didn't say that, actually.
That was in the statement,
wasn't it, that was leaked out. Was that not the case? Was she not upset the night before and talked to you the night before?
What we said is there, and it was the next morning, Madeline had said to us, why didn't you come when we cried last night? And at the time, we thought, that's odd, and you know, we looked at each other and we asked her directly when she meant, and she just dropped it and moved on.
On the same day as that BBC interview, the McCanns were interviewed in the Sky News studios. There, they encountered the same question about the crying incident.
Anybody with young children will understand that children cry, they wake up at night. During that week, there was one night, and we can't give too much detail because it's part of the investigation file, but there was one night where Madeline had come through and one of the other twins was crying.
On May 4, the day after Maddie was reported missing, detectives took Kate and Jerry's mobile phones. They wanted to check if their two handsets held any potentially important information. In his book, Detective Gonzalo Amaral claimed the call log history on Kate and Jerry's phones had been manipulated. A call log on your mobile phone is the simple digital record showing who you've called or who called you. Amaral believed someone could have deleted some of Kate and Jerry's call log history in the hours after Maddie was reported missing, while the frantic nighttime search around the Ocean Club Resort, streets and beach was underway. Police looked at the call log on Kate's phone. It showed Kate had made no phone calls to anyone between the late afternoon of Friday, April 27, and 45 minutes past midnight on Friday, May 4. Remember, Kate reported Maddie missing at 10 p.m. the night before. That's roughly a period of 7 days. Amaral wrote he found that somewhat unusual. In Kate's defense, she was on holiday for most of that time. And it's pretty common for people on holiday abroad to drastically reduce the number of calls they make and take. Police also looked at Jerry's call log. It showed he made no calls, nor received any phone calls at all before May 4. Despite the fact Jerry's call log contained no activity, on Kate's phone, on the night of May 3, the night Maddie vanished, police saw Kate had received a call from Jerry at 11:17 p.m. But on Jerry's phone, on his calls made history, there was no record of him calling Kate. Nothing. There was only a record of calls made from May 4 onwards. That triggered the theory that the McCanns' phones had been manipulated before they were given to police. In a translation of his book, Amaral wrote, "How can that be explained? And always the same question, why?" I asked a former US Marshal, Mark McLeish, about this. Mark is a specialist in detecting deception in police interviews and witness statements. Mark told me that deleting the call logs on their mobile phones was odd and that police would consider any indication of such an act a red flag.
You have to use your common sense and ask yourself, do you go through your phone and delete all of your logs? And then, yeah, there may be some things you delete just to clear things out, or like I'll delete my text messages usually. But the phone calls themselves, the ones I received or made, are usually just stored there. And so for somebody to delete phone calls, who they were calling, who called them, would raise a red flag and something we'd want to take a look at.
A couple of weeks after Maddie vanished, Kate and Jerry began making car journeys to the west of Praia da Luz, into remote farmland, coastal areas and hill country. Cell phone towers were pinged by Kate and Jerry's phones. You can see maps suggesting where Kate and Jerry drove in their rental car on 9.com.au/Maddie. We've mapped out some of those journeys, beginning with June 9. You'll remember the McCann's rental car from episode 4, the silver Renault Scenic. These trips were made in that car, which was hired 3 weeks after Maddie vanished, where the DNA samples were collected. But back to the phone call logs. As the investigation got underway, Portuguese police requested detailed phone data from the mobile phone operators of Kate Jerry and all of the other Tapas 7. Jerry's phone data from Vodafone revealed differences with the call log police had taken from his phone. Remember, Jerry's call log appeared to show he made and received no calls prior to May 4. But the Vodafone data revealed Jerry had made and received a total of 9 phone calls on the days of April 29, May 2 and May 3. The Vodafone data also showed Kate had used her phone to call Jerry twice on April 29, their second day in prior deluge. Remember, when police examined Kate's phone on May 4, the record showed no such calls were made. The Vodafone data also revealed Jerry McCann received 14 text message notifications from his Vodafone voicemail service on May 2. Those 14 text message alerts were deemed to be of interest in a confidential Portuguese police report. That police report must have been leaked to the media, because a couple of UK papers suddenly began reporting on those 14 texts. A UK Telegraph story was headlined, "Jerry McCann's text messages probed," while a Daily Mail headline read, "Riddle of 14 text messages sent and received by Jerry McCann just before Madeline vanished." Shortly after the case was shelved, unsolved, Jerry spoke about those text messages in an interview on Portugal's SIC news channel.
"No one has asked to see any of my text messages. There is no way there were 16 messages on the day, or even, you know, the day after we got hundreds of text messages.
Jerry hardly ever sends text messages until after Madeline was taken.
So, you know, it's actually rubbish."
Early on the morning of May 2, at 8:21 a.m, Jane Tanner, who was one of the Tapas 7, received a text message from a friend, a woman called Christine Flaxman. 90 minutes later, at 10:05 a.m, Jane Tanner replied. Christine Flaxman is a doctor. In fact, she's an expert in DNA. She worked at the UK's Forensic Science Service, the FSS, specialising in DNA profiling techniques, from 1998 to 2007. The FSS was the British lab where the DNA samples from the McCann's apartment and rental car were sent for analysis. While working at the FSS, Christine also acted as an expert court witness, reporting the results of casework. In April 2008, Jane Tanner was interviewed by British police on behalf of Portuguese detectives. Near the end of a 4.5-hour interview, a British detective asked Jane about her text message exchange with Christine Flaxman. Police wanted to know why the two had been in contact and what they'd discussed. Jane Tanner showed some confusion over how Christine's phone number and name had been stored in her phone. The number had been stored under the name John Claxman. John, it turns out, is Christine's husband. Despite Jane and Christine being friends, Jane told the detective she thought Christine's surname was Paxman, not Flaxman. It was never resolved why Christine Flaxman was saved in Jane's phone under John Claxman. Shortly after Kate and Jerry were declared arguidos, the Portuguese prosecutor lodged a request at the Portimão court. He wanted access to all the text messages that were sent and received by the McCanns and the Tapas 7 after they landed in Portugal. He wanted to know what was written in those text messages. He wanted the mobile phone companies to turn this information over to police. But the judge declined the motion, citing privacy concerns. The prosecutor tried again, but this time he suggested all text messages could first be given to a judge to read, and any text messages deemed irrelevant to the case could be thrown out by the judge, and any text messages deemed potentially important could be handed on to detectives. Frustratingly for police, the judge denied that request on privacy grounds. Like the Claxman-Flaxman oddity, there are a number of curiosities about this case which have sparked a large number of theories. Here's one of them involving the creche sign-in register at the Ocean Club Resort. Each day the McCanns would check Maddie, Sean and Emily into two kids' clubs. Maddie was in the lobster group, while Sean and Emily were in jellyfish, a group for babies and younger children. They'd be dropped off after breakfast around 9 and picked up around 12:30 for lunch. Then they'd spend a couple of hours with Kate and Jerry. And afterwards, Maddie and the twins would go back to their clubs around 2:30 p.m. and be picked up about 5:30 p.m. For 5 days from April 29 to May 3, that was the McCanns' daily routine. But on Tuesday, May 1 and Wednesday, May 2, something changed. On May 1, the kids' club register shows Jerry sign Maddie into the afternoon session at 2:30 p.m. But there's no record of Maddie being signed out later that day. And on May 2, the day after the quiz night and that alleged late-night crying incident, there are two more discrepancies on the sign-in sheet. In the morning, Jerry signed Maddie in. But at 12:30 p.m, neither Kate nor Jerry signed Maddie out. The signature is Katrina Baker's, the nanny in charge of the Lobster Club. Now, looking over those sign-in sheets, Katrina Baker did sign other children out that week, so it wasn't necessarily highly unusual. However, later on May 2, another unusual signature appears on Maddie's Kids Club register. Kate McCann signs Maddie in at 2:45 p.m. and at 5:30 p.m, Kate signs Maddie out. But at 5:30 p.m, Kate's signature changes. It goes from being Kate McCann to Kate Healy. Healy is Kate's maiden name. Over 5 days, Kate signs Maddie, Sean and Emily in and out on 20 separate occasions. 19 of those times, she signs as Kate McCann. But on one time, on May 2, after quiz night and after the crying incident, she signs in as Kate Healy. On the next episode of Maddie, we analyse Jerry's response to the one question many around the world want answered, and battle lines are drawn between the UK and Portuguese media.
I desperately wanted to shout out, it's not true, but when it's your voice against the powerful media, you know, it just doesn't hold weight.
The Maddie podcast is reported, written and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.